Blog Talk Radio.
And good day, listeners. You are on the Right Stream Radio Network, and this is Military Monday. I am your host, John Gresham, and it is a beautiful, now it feels like summer day here in Northern Virginia. It is warm, it is muggy, and it is pretty much summer here in Fairfax, Virginia. And today we're going to talk about a phenomenon and a book that goes and tells us a lot about how to deal with it. The phenomenon is what we call the mirror syndrome. And what we mean by mirror syndrome is that it is the tendency for people to go and look at another person and to go and judge them, evaluate them, set their expectations of them based upon their own lives, their own experiences, and what they think. Now, this may strike you as pretty common, certainly nothing threatening, except if you're in the U.S. military and you do that to a foreign officer, a leader, maybe even an enemy, there's a bad habit on the part of Americans to get surprised by these kinds of people. We just have this tendency to go and base how we expect others to fight, behave, and act upon what we would do. And we're going to talk a little bit about that phenomenology, and we're going to talk about a book that gives you an opportunity to go and turn that around and make it a little different. Our guests today are two of the more interesting people I know in the business of military history. A big part of that interest is the fact that they are father and son. The father, Tom Hone, is actually the gentleman who 30 years ago helped me to start writing professionally, something for which I am both eternally grateful and I will never forgive him because it radically changed the course of where I was going in life. And his son, Trent Hone. They are both authors and historians, particularly where naval warfare is concerned. They have done books for the U.S. Naval Institute Press and, in fact, have a book together with Naval Institute Press on the U.S. Navy during the interwar years from 1919 to 1941. And these are two of the finest gentlemen I know in this business, and if I'm going to spend an afternoon chatting about the nuances of how you fight on the seas, these are two of the guys you want at the table. Tom, Trent, are you there, guys?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, and I'm
and
here,
Trent?
Too.
Excellent.
Yep.
Tom, I know I just gave a rather flippant and abbreviated biography of you, but for the listeners who don't know you, tell them a little bit about yourself and where you're from and why you are considered a pretty smart guy when it comes to the history of naval warfare these days.
Well, I'm a former senior executive in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and I also worked in positions in the acquisition bureaucracy in the Navy Department, particularly in the Naval Assistance Command. So I have a background in working on defense issues as a manager and analyst, and I also have this interest in the history, particularly the history of the United States Navy in the 20th century. So I have combined those two things. I go back and forth, or have gone back and forth, from government positions to working on my own research and doing other things. So that's my background.
And Trent, other than being the son of Tom, what is your background professionally, and what brought you to go ahead and be so interested in naval warfare?
Well, my primary interest is the study of organizations and how they learn. As a day job, one of the things that I do is help software teams and organizations understand what they're doing, their processes and their methodologies, learn from that, and use it to get better. And there's a lot of overlap between how organizations and business are doing this today and how military organizations have done this in the past and continue to do it. And I have found that the U.S. Navy in the 20s and 30s and 1940s provides some very fertile ground for looking at this and how organizations can learn effectively from their experience. A lot of that dovetails nicely with what the Japanese were doing because they were opponents, particularly in the 40s, and we'll be talking about that more today.
Very good. And let's start with that in that let me throw out on the table a supposition that I laid out a little earlier here, that we view others as we view ourselves, almost like looking in a mirror. And why is this, and what are the dangers of it? And I'm going to start with you, Tom, and then I'd like to hear what you think, Trent.
Well, the dangers are that the other side may look at the world very differently than you do, may have different aims, may think differently. And therefore, when you try to influence them, their thinking, their actions, it may not work, and you may not understand why. That's why it's important to avoid mirror imaging.
And Trent, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think we all come at situations and our experiences with a set of assumptions or a frame of reference, and that informs the experiences that, and the lessons that we draw from the events and circumstances that happened to us. And I think one of the things that's quite fascinating about the Pacific theater in World War II is how different the frames of reference and perspectives were between the Allies or primarily the Americans and then the Japanese on the other side.
Yeah, I
you
can
make
talk
a point here that – go ahead. Please, Tom.
Yeah, there's another factor here too, John, which is especially important in the war in the Pacific in World War II, and that was that both nations that engaged in the greatest conflict there, that is the Japanese and the United States, both of them had similar needs. That is, they needed to have fleets that could move away from the central country out into distant areas and engage with the enemy, with the opposition. And so the fleets tend to look alike. They have battleships, they have aircraft carriers, they have cruisers, they have destroyers, submarines. They do that because they need ships to perform certain missions, and those missions are very similar on both sides.
But, Trent, correct me if I'm wrong, if you look at Japan and the United States, when you get down into the nuances of those ships and the systems they carry, there's some very different ideas being put forth between Japan and the United States, correct?
Yeah, there are. And a lot of the assumptions that they bring to the conflict are different. There's one example that I remember specifically. It's not something that Hara brings up exactly in his book because he wasn't involved in that battle. But right before Tsavo Island, the Japanese cruisers, as they're approaching Guadalcanal, are sighted by some scouting planes. And the report suggests that they have some seaplane tenders in their midst. And so Turner and the others at Guadalcanal assume that the Japanese are going to set up a seaplane base and bomb the anchorage of Guadalcanal with those seaplanes. This is obviously not what they have in mind. They approach at night. The Battle of Tsavo Island is the result. It's a night surface action. But these assumptions that were in the minds of the American officers informed what their responses to that sighting report, and they were not expecting the kind of night action that showed up. The Japanese were much more aggressive, at least early on, in terms of seeking out night action, and that's one of those significant differences.
Tom and Trent, one of the ways that I was taught to go and provide you with some insights into what the other guy was thinking was to read about what the other guy was thinking. Seek out books and articles and other media written by foreign military personnel, particularly senior officers, who had combat experience and could provide a perspective on what had happened on the other side during a particular action. What do you think of the value of this basic learning idea?
Well, let me go first. It only works if the other side has people who talk. It only works if they write things. And all the U.S. Navy had to go on was the war between Japan and Russia in 1904-1905. And in that case, what you see is the Japanese Navy seeking a major engagement with the Russian Navy so that they can defeat the Imperial Russian Navy and dominate the waters off Manchuria and Korea. That's what they wanted to do. So if you were an American officer in the years between World War One and World War Two, you could watch the Japanese Navy from a distance, but it was very difficult to find things written by Japanese naval officers that were at all current. You could see what they were writing about in that 1904-1905 period, the period running up to World War One, but the technology had changed. And so it was difficult for Americans to obtain unclassified accounts based on the experiences of Japanese Navy officers. Now, the U.S. Navy listened to Japanese communications and tried to watch Japanese maneuvers in the years between World War I and World War II, and that was very important. But it's not the same thing as reading literature that's out in the open. That sort of thing just didn't exist on the Japanese
side. Now,
Trent,
it did exist on a limited basis with the Germans, and we have the examples of Erwin Rommel, Heinz Guderian, and others who wrote important books in the interwar period, laying out in many ways the way in which Nazi Germany would fight World War II. Talk a little bit about the value of that, and we, of course, have the reference by General Patton shown in the famous movie where he's yelling at the top of his lungs, "I read your book." Talk a little bit about what kind of influence that can have.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because during this whole exchange I've been thinking about that quote. And Rommel's book is quite interesting and it gives some insight into his thinking and his viewpoints. I think there can be a great deal of value from that, from looking at the writings of officers from the other side, and certainly from a civilian perspective. It gives you insight into a way a military is thinking. If you want to know more, for example, about what the U.S. military is thinking or experiencing. We have those kinds of things available now from the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think it's quite valuable, but I think also it's important to try to understand the context, because one of the things that will happen quite often, and I think this sort of thing was going on between the Germans and the French in the interwar period, is even though you can get a good sense of what it is that the enemy is trying to do from observing their maneuvers or watching their force structure and acquisition process and reading their journals, you're going to interpret that, unless you're careful, in light of your own assumptions and your own frame. And it becomes possible to still be a victim of this sort of mirror imaging unless there's a mechanism that allows you to test your own underlying assumptions and beliefs. And where that doesn't exist, even having that avenue and that window might not be enough to really understand what it is a potential opponent is going to do.
A good point, although, as we have said, it does provide at least a point of entry in adjusting one's thinking process. And let's talk a little bit about that, because, Tom, you made a point that was very important a couple minutes ago, and that is Imperial Japan, from pretty much the time that Commodore Perry kicked in the door and said, "Here we are, you get to join the Western world," to the time we dropped the atom bomb, we did not have a very good, shall we say, set of optics to watch Imperial Japan during her developmental years up through World War II, did we?
Well, no. I mean, you could, again, as Trent said, you could look at the raw information population size, the growth of the economy, the kind of industries that were developing, and what was being done with industrial output. All of that was more or less available. But what I think comes out of the good World War II histories that focus on the Pacific is that it was difficult, even for some Japanese officers, and of course we see that in Captain Hara's book, it was difficult even for them to understand the thinking of the high command. What was it like? What were they thinking? Why were they planning the way they were doing it? And why were they giving the orders they were giving? That was difficult, and I think that comes out in his book. And if it was difficult for him, then it was certainly difficult for the people on the other side, that is, for the people of the United States.
Very true and very, very insightful. And for our listeners, if you want to go and ask a question or give a comment to either of the Hones or myself, please feel free to call in on our call-in line, area code 347-945-7246. Again, that's area code 347-945-7246. Trent, I want to start out our talk about focusing in on Captain Hara and his book called Japanese Destroyer Captain by talking a little bit about what the world that Captain Hara wrote this book was like. Obviously, he wrote it after World War II, as did a number of Japanese authors who wrote books that were thankfully and most prosperously translated here in the United States and published in American English. Talk a little bit, though, about the world that Captain Hara lived in and what was his place in Japanese society in the late 40s and early 50s when he was writing this book?
Well, that's a good point, because we can – one of the things that's very important, I think, in drawing effective lessons from this book and understanding – where Hara is coming from is to look at that context, right? So Japan has just recently been defeated, and they've been brutally defeated, right? Atomic bombs drive them into defeat. And so he's writing in a context where the militarism and the kind of aggressiveness that led to the war is no longer acceptable and being looked down upon and being blamed for the kinds of problems that Japan has to endure as it goes through rebuilding and becoming...
Senior military officers, assuming they survived, were being heavily ostracized by Japanese society, man-on-the-street stuff.
Yes, exactly. And so some of that comes through in Hara's book. And these are some of the pieces that I found most interesting, because he's very down on the kinds of physical abuse that he went through at the Japanese Naval Academy at Ajima, and the sorts of things he sees among other ships and with officers even under his command who, you know, physically abuse their subordinates. He also talks about how this creates a culture where people aren't ready to question and aren't ready to learn and aren't ready to embrace new things. And you contrast that with an older, or what he sees as an older Japanese style. His influence by his grandfather, who was a samurai, and he mentions the Book of Five Rings by Miyamoto Musashi, and how there is within Japanese culture this deftness and an ability to adjust, and something he sees is very different from the dominant militaristic culture that led to the war, and he tries to associate himself and his actions with that. And I think it's very interesting to see, and it's very much a reaction to the context within which he's writing at the time.
That's a great point, and I want to come back to it a little later when we talk about his personal development of his own war plan and ethos for fighting his war in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, now, Japanese Destroyer Commander was the product of an interesting individual that we all kind of know as a legend in the publishing business, Ian Ballantyne, who had his own imprint, Ballantyne, for many years. But Ian made friends with people who traveled overseas and got to know former opponents in Germany, in Italy, and in Japan. And one of those men that went scouting for him was a guy we all know as Madman Marty Caden. And he brought really the first three good books about the Japanese War back that we know today as Zero, Samurai, and The Zero Fighter, assisted ably by, and I'm going to try and pronounce these properly, Matsuki Okamayo, Jiro Hokusini, and another gentleman we've all come to know as Fred Sato. Talk a little bit about these books and what, how they came to America and what effect they had on the culture of the history community in the United States.
Well, all I can say is that I came to the books rather late. I fell into this business of naval history quite by accident. And one of the first things I wanted to do was to learn a little bit more about the Japanese, about their culture of command. Trent was talking about that, about their methods and so on. And when you looked around, you had to look at those books that had been brought to the United States, translated into English, and published in the 50s and 60s. There weren't that many of them. Now, this created a problem. And the problem had two sides. One was you needed more material, actual material you could trust coming out of Japan. And second, you needed to be able to read it. And if it was in Japanese and you didn't speak Japanese, you faced a problem. So a lot of Americans who didn't speak Japanese grabbed up these books because they were the source. And it took a long time for two things to happen. That is, for people who really understood Japanese to come in and look at this literature in its original Japanese form. And the second thing that happened was we started getting more official documentation from the Japanese government so that the pool of information grew. But when I started to get interested in this sort of thing, the pool of information was very small. It was these books. And if they hadn't been brought in, there'd be nothing. You'd have nothing to work on. Now there's a lot more.
And these are very much foundational books for people like ourselves who have an interest in naval history, and they certainly guided the people who have given us the most useful popular history books, be it Walter Lord or John Parshall of late.
Yeah, that's true. Again, you have to realize that if you looked at all the material that was available, including the official material from the National Archives, available in the U.S. Navy, and then compared it to what was available in English on the Imperial Japanese Navy, the difference was huge. And so these were foundational books, and I think a lot of folks sort of took them because there was nothing else, and then did not stop to think that there might be something else there, that these authors might have had certain motives in writing the way they did. Understandable motives, for example, but nevertheless motives that you had to keep in mind. And so, for example, on Midway, the book by Mitsuo Fuchida and Masataki Okamaya, that was a critical book. Everybody read it. It was in English, and it was written well, and everyone said, well, this is it. This is how it's done. Well, not quite, because it was a small piece of all the material that would eventually surface.
And obviously others would begin the process of correcting the record. And
yeah.
Trent, let's go back and talk for just a second about a word you just used in your last input that is so important here, and that is the question of context. That all of these books, especially Japanese Destroyer Captain, are first and foremost personal memoirs. What are the values and vices of personal memoirs?
Oh, yeah, that's really important. I'm glad you brought that up, because what we're seeing here is very much Hara's perspective. So there are elements of this book where he's off and he's wrong from a pure historical perspective. For example, if you look at some of his accounts of some of the battles in the Solomons off Guadalcanal that he participated in, he doesn't give an accurate accounting of, you know, who was shooting at whom or what happened to certain U.S. ships or the flow of the battle. But he gives you a very accurate sense of his what he saw and what his emotional state in it was and how he felt about the battle and other things. And so you get a chance to step in his shoes, less from a historian, bird's eye view, clear hindsight 2020 sense, and more of a here is a man who's immersed in it and trying to figure out, now looking back, you know, what did all this mean? What impact did this have on my own self and Japanese culture and all the rest of this? And looking at it through that sort of a lens. And I think it's quite powerful, as long as we accept that that's where it is. If we go looking at it for specific details about what ship was shooting at what ship and why another one was hit and another one was missed, I don't think we're going to get the most accurate accounting, just because of the problems that we run into when we look at a first-person account of a given battle.
All good and valid points, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Captain Hara after our break here. We're going to take a short break and run a few network messages, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Captain Hara and the world he fought World War II in, the Imperial Japanese Navy. This is the Right Stream Radio Network.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann, Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them a lot.
We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can. But we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives. And for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. what a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And this is Military Monday. We are back, and we're going to talk a little more about the book Japanese Destroyer Commander, the writer, Captain Tamichi Hara, with Naval Institute authors, along with father and son, Tom and Trent Hone. Are you there, guys?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, very good. Trent, you were talking a few minutes ago about the world that Captain Hara lived in and grew up in. Talk a little more about what it was, from his experience base, to be an officer in the Japanese Navy, and the path that he wound up taking when he found himself in command of a destroyer at the opening of World War II.
Well, I think Hara's experience opens a window for us into the Japanese Navy that is quite good, because he was a captain of a destroyer, and the Japanese emphasized the use of what we would now term asymmetric approaches to try to deal with the fact that the United States Navy was so much larger than what they had. And this was a result of the treaty framework that had been in place through much of the interwar period. The Japanese were restricted in terms of the number of battleships they could build and the number of cruisers to less than what the Americans and the British, for that matter, were also allowed. And so, amongst other things, they saw very large and very powerful torpedoes as a way to deal with this numeric disadvantage, and invested in new technologies such as oxygen power for these 24-inch torpedoes so that they could have a range roughly equivalent to battleship guns. And they developed approaches to use these at night and to attack what was anticipated to be an approaching American force from multiple directions at night with these, and hopefully wreak sufficient havoc to allow them to have success in what they expected to be the climactic day battle would follow. And Hara evidently was instrumental in revising Japanese destroyer tactics for the use of torpedoes. He talked about this in his book, and this is we talked a bit about documents from Japan and the relative inability. This is a document I would love to see, because I'm not sure exactly what this entailed, but it appears to have involved increasing the level of aggressiveness and also the mathematical precision with which Japanese destroyers carried out their attacks. And it's a great effect in the Second World War. This is they were quite good at this, Hara and his colleagues. So I'd be very curious to know what that says and what it was that Hara did to change it and how it differed from before. But it's certainly something that's quite important.
Tom, you and I have been talking about this particular document now for over 30 years. One of my earliest notes to you was asking if you had ever seen it in the archives down at the Navy Yard. And certainly his, if his account of his rewriting of this is correct, he obviously was a very important individual in terms of the capabilities of the Japanese Navy. But at the same time, he was also restricted because he had gone and been designated as a technical specialist, not someone who would ever command fleets in battle, correct?
Oh, yeah. The Japanese made a very serious error in the years before World War II, and that was to take young officers and push them in different career paths, doing that very early and not giving them a chance to switch over and do something else later on in their careers. You don't see the concept that you see in the U.S. Navy of the unrestricted line officer. This is a very interesting notion because it says, look, we'll create these unrestricted line officers and we'll set them loose. Some of them are going to be technically minded. Some are going to be tactically minded. Some may not be very good at any of these things. We'll figure that out as they go through their careers. The Japanese typed people too soon, and that's what you get out of this book. And Hara sort of talks about the consequences of that for himself and for others, and he talks about it indirectly as a negative consequence for the Imperial Navy of Japan. And I think he's right.
And, Trent, they get a lot of this from the fact that they, like many other navies around the world, looked to an example, they themselves mirroring when they looked at another service, and the service that they tended to base themselves around was, of course, the British Royal Navy, correct?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Japanese, when they, towards the end of the 19th century, when they wanted to assert themselves more greatly on the world stage, looked to the two dominant paradigms in their respective services. So the Navy looked at the Royal Navy, and the Imperial Army of Japan looked at the Prussian Army in Europe, and the two of them emulated these most supreme of the European models at that time. And the Japanese also had a partnership, an alliance with the Royal Navy through World War I, and it was only under the terms of the Washington Treaty in 1922 that came to an end.
There's something else I want to talk about, John. And you see it in the Hara book, which is that success doesn't necessarily lead to promotion. What leads to promotion is going by the doctrine. And the doctrine is made by these more intelligent officers who are pulled out of the ranks of the officer corps relatively early in their careers. So Hara talks about he became a Rear Admiral Tanaka. And he's a success around Guadalcanal, not in the sense that he's doing everything that the more senior officers want him to do, but he's fighting that battle, and he's doing as well as he can. And he gets pulled out of it, partly because he's exhausted, but also because, you know, this is not the battle they want to fight from Tokyo. Well, Hara says, that's too bad. This is where we are, guys, and we have to do the best we can with what we have.
Yeah, and you see a number of officers throughout the war, be it Tanaka, who was strikingly well-known and feared by his opponents on the other side in the United States and Australian navies. And at the same time, you've got people like Mikawa and even Fushida and Genda, who are taken down either for their political views or the fact that they don't want to fight the way the top leadership wants to fight.
Oh, yeah. And what's interesting about the interaction between the two navies, the U.S. Navy and the Japanese Navy, is Admiral King's decision after Midway to go right into Guadalcanal. And others said, wait a minute, we're not ready for that. We haven't been able to plan for it effectively. We haven't been able to practice. And, in fact, the practices they held before Guadalcanal were not really a success. And yet it's Admiral King who pushes the U.S. Navy onto the offensive to go after the Japanese. And I've always suspected that he did that to keep the Japanese off balance, because they had knocked the U.S. Navy, the Royal Navy, and the Dutch off balance in the first 6 months of the war. And King sort of felt it was time to go back the other way, to give them some of their own medicine back and see how they responded to it. And as it turned out, they didn't respond very well at all.
Tom,
yeah,
it's interesting
exactly.
You bring that up, because if you look at the recently remastered and reissued Nimitz Gray Book, which we did a show on a few weeks ago, very, very early, because it actually covers the period after Pearl Harbor where Admiral Kimmel has been relieved, Admiral Pai is in charge, and Admiral Nimitz is coming in about 10 days after the attack, you see out of Admiral Pai a very defensively minded, let's not go out and stick our nose out, and yet the instant Nimitz arrives, you can feel, just in the words of the Gray Book, a sudden desire to get out there, knock heads, put the Japanese, as you point out so adroitly, off balance, and go on the offensive. I find it interesting that only now, 70, 75 years later, we're beginning to see the reality of what was actually going on in the minds of our own senior leaders, much less the Japanese. Trent?
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on that. I think it's very clear that that's what King had in mind. There's a very strong current that runs through the U.S. Navy's doctrine in the interwar period and well into World War II about the importance of aggressiveness and tempo. And you see it at the tactical level, where there's a strong desire to attack effectively first, in words of Wayne Hughes, and seize opportunities that are created through that action. And, King was well-versed in that, and he is taking that, and Nimitz as well, to the higher levels of command. And so they're looking at a campaign against Japan and trying to figure out, all right, how do we seize the initiative at the strategic and operational levels? And once we do that, how do we keep the pace up so that the Japanese aren't able to get back on their feet? Ultimately, after Guadalcanal, that's what results.
Tom, one of the things that comes across about the book Japanese Destroyer Captain is, as Trent and I were pointing out earlier before the break, it is a personal memoir. And, in the present-day context of so-called personal memoirs by politicians and generals, the publicists always like to throw at us that it's an intimate portrait. And yet, I don't remember the last time I've ever seen an intimate portrait of a man as self-deprecating and honest as we see Hara talk about in his book. I mean, talk a little bit about Hara the man as he sat there contemplating going to war in the days before Pearl Harbor.
Well, Hara is a real professional. He is dedicated to the leadership of his society, to what he perceives as the legitimate order in Japan, and he's ready to go fight. He's not a warrior in that sense. He is a professional. So he's thinking always about equipment, about tactics, about supply and logistics, and especially about the morale of his own sailors. He's really a kind of modern man, not someone who sets out to engage in the enemy and destroy himself if necessary. It's not a sense of glory, it's a sense of victory. How do we achieve victory? What do we do? What do we do in a tactical sense? I recommend this book because one of the things you find as you go through it, especially when he gets into the war, when he gets into the battles around Guadalcanal, one of the things you see is his struggle to stay alert, struggle to keep his leadership capabilities in the face of constant threats. What happens to him in the melees, in the destroyer and cruiser battles around Guadalcanal? It's absolutely fascinating. And he's the professional, and he's trying to stay a professional, and he knows what it means. And I think if you looked at other navies of the time, you'd see something very similar among their younger officers, this commitment to professionalism, and then the struggle to sustain that in the face of all the difficulties they face.
And there's something about that which I found very interesting in Hara's experience is he goes from being the captain of a destroyer to the captain of a division. And through most of the experiences that he has at that command level, he still talks in his narrative as if he's the commander of this destroyer, and he's making orders to that destroyer. Now, some of this is because most of the time his division wasn't available to him, and he was commanding just the one ship. But even when he gets beyond that state and has other ships in company with him, it's very surprising to me how focused he remains on the single ship that he's on. And I'm not entirely sure what to make of this, but my initial sense is that he is so used to and comfortable with that level of command that it's what he defaults to under stress. And so there may be something about him or about the environment that he's in the Japanese Navy at that time that restricts his ability to step up to the next level of command. And I'm not entirely sure what that is, but it's an interesting feature of his narrative.
You point that out, and it's certainly an interesting commentary on his situational awareness in battle. He also talks about the fact that he was a human being. This was not a perfect man. This was not a virtuous man. He talks about his own very heavy drinking in social situations, his rather brutal honesty when inebriated, and even the fact that he, of course, took advantage of the various aspects of being a man in Japanese society, up to and including other vices other than just alcohol. So you have him being honest about himself as a person, and yet at the same time, he's contemplating his place in the world and asking the question, okay, how do I get through this? And Trent, Tom, run with this. Take those two thoughts and run with it.
Well, I'll let Trent do it first because he's spent more time studying destroyer tactics and destroyer engagements than I have.
Yeah, I'm probably more comfortable with that than I am talking about the advantages one might have as a male in Japanese culture. But, I think he's got a great willingness, Hara does, to learn from experience and to try to look back at battles that he's fought in and understand lessons that come forward. And this is where I think there's a very interesting dovetailing with his comfort as commanding a destroyer. Right? Yeah, John, you mentioned that impacts his situational awareness. Absolutely it does. He's aware of what's going on within the context of his ship. He seems to have a sixth sense. Some of this may be, you know, telling history with rose-colored glasses, but he seems to have a sixth sense of danger, can anticipate when American destroyers or other ships are going to fire at him. And so he's got this willingness to learn, and chides his colleagues in the Imperial Japanese Navy for lacking that same ability and that same understanding. It's interesting to me that he focuses very much on the tactical sphere. Certainly this is his area of expertise, where he's comfortable, but he doesn't look beyond that for explanation to why the Japanese aren't winning the war. The two things that he calls out most specifically are radar, or more specifically, radar-controlled gunfire, and then skip bombing. There are certain passages in the book where he seems deathly afraid of skip bombing and the kinds of attacks that American B-25s and others were famous for in the Pacific. But he doesn't seem to have a terribly good sense of the kinds of tactics the Americans are using on him and his colleagues. Certainly he calls out radar-controlled gunfire, but he doesn't seem to see the rapid evolution of command and control improvements that come about in the U.S. Navy. Now, certainly that's probably something that wouldn't be too visible to him, but there's a clear line and progression from early battles in late 1942, where the Americans aren't terribly well coordinated, to the mid to late 1943, where the radar and combat information center allows distributed forces to coordinate their actions effectively. The Japanese never quite figure this out, and that comes out in Hara's comments, particularly before and during the Battle of Empress Augusta Bay, where the formation that he's in gets confused, there's a collision, and then the next thing that happens is the American shells are landing around them and hitting them on the first couple salvos. So there's an element beyond the tactical sphere that Hara seems somewhat ignorant of in terms of command and control and the effectiveness of handling forces in battle. And that's a little surprising to me. And I wonder if that's because of his experience and his categorization or channeling as a tactical destroyer torpedo expert, or if that speaks to something a little bit more pervasive within the Japanese Navy's command structure. And I'm not sure of the answer, but I think it's an interesting question.
Go ahead.
Well, that gets us back to something earlier, which is that if you get a Navy on the run, to use a phrase from basketball, if you can run and gun them, then they don't have the time to sit down and evaluate what's been going on. They have a real tough time using lessons learned. And I got a sense of that from Hara's book. They get back into a main base, and usually the ship that he's on is damaged or it needs repair. The engines aren't good. The crew's exhausted. And so they sort of get themselves fixed up to go back into the battle again. But I don't see the sorts of things that the U.S. Navy did in the Pacific, which was to sit down and evaluate experience and say, well, you know, what have we learned? And again, you see the value of pushing another Navy, whether it's because you have better tactics or you have better weapons or because you have more stuff, you keep pushing that other Navy, and they have trouble staying on their feet, so to speak. They get knocked down, and they have a tough time getting up. When they get up, they're ready to fight the fight they've already fought and not the new fight that you're trying to push them into.
Tom, that takes us into one other point about Hara himself, which is he writes in the book as he contemplates the coming war, and he thinks about the size of the U.S. Navy and the industrial potential of the United States, and he asks the question, oh, dear Lord, how will I go and, you know, survive this crucible? And he looks through the military classics that are on his bookshelf in his small captain's cabin. He looks to Sun Tzu, The Art of War, as well as others, and he comes up with a basic idea, which is never do the same thing twice. Never do it the same way, the same place, the same time. Talk a little bit about what elements there were in Hara personally that allowed him to survive this incredible beating that the Japanese Navy took between 1941 and 1945.
Well, personally, he's very committed. He's also physically strong, which I think is a factor in his survival. And also, he wasn't marked out as one of the great commanders. And so, in a sense, he's left alone to look for some ideas on his own, and he did that. And also, when the war comes, when he's in the middle of it, he realizes he has some freedom. Yes, there is a doctrine that he has to deal with, and there are other ships that he has to coordinate with, and so on. But there is a kind of freedom that comes, especially you get into the destroyer engagements, which may start out as structured events, but then they become melees. They become unstructured. And this gives him a kind of freedom, and he seems to relish this. I mean, it wears him out. It causes him all kinds of trouble. But, you know, as a human being, he comes through that. He deals with it. It's almost as if he's cut out for it. Now, we have to take his words at face value, but I found that very, very interesting. There's something else I want to throw out, too. His focus before the war is on the U.S. Navy. But as Trent said, the Japanese had used the Royal Navy as a model. He doesn't really talk about the Royal Navy very much. I mean, he's not sent to deal with them. And, oh, by the way, they're kicked out of the Pacific rather early. So he doesn't deal with them. But I don't see that. I see his focus on the United States because that's the big Navy. And he knows it's getting bigger. And he knows it's persistent. He can't, you know, there's not time for the Japanese to have a significant pause getting pushed over and over again by the U.S. Navy.
Trent, throughout the book, and really for any of us who have studied the Imperial Japanese fleet during World War II, there is nothing that was a bigger boogeyman on the Japanese side to us than a weapon they called the Type 93 oxygen-fueled torpedo, and that the United States simply called the Long Lance. What was it, and why is Hara so intimately tied with the reputation of this weapon?
Right. Well, those are the torpedoes. Those are those very long-range, oxygen-fueled, 24-inch diameter torpedoes that the Japanese develop as their offset to one of their offsets, to being unable to build a battleship fleet that is comparable to that of the United States in terms of numbers. And Hara rewrites the torpedo manual, and as a destroyer captain, his destroyers have a lot of these, and they've got not only what are in the launchers ready to go, but also a reload, and they use those, and they prove to be quite effective. One of the things that is interesting, if you look in detail, I remember reading a mathematical analysis of these kinds of actions that tried to understand tactics and effectiveness of various weapon systems and so on. And it placed the Long Lance extremely, extremely high up on the scale. I think it rated it as probably the most effective weapon or single weapon system in employment in these night actions in the Solomons, in World War II, the Solomon Island chain. But if you look into detail at some of these fights, what emerges is in the early ones, most of the time, it's whoever sights the other guy first is going to win. And the weapons that are decisive are the guns. That happens with the Japanese at Tsavo Island. They use their gunfire to decimate the cruisers that are guarding the anchorage. Then at Cape Esperance, Admiral Scott turns the tables, does the same sort of thing, sees the Japanese first, opens fire with guns. It's only once you get later, and Tanaka's victory in the Battle of Tassafaronga is really the first example where the Japanese destroyers are free to act as a unit, use these very long-range and very powerful torpedoes to secure a victory against an American cruiser line that was trying to disrupt their resupply mission. And that continues for several months. The United States fails to understand how long-range these torpedoes are. There was a doctrine that had been developed prior to Tassafaronga that was essentially to remain beyond 10,000 yards and use cruiser gunfire to destroy the Japanese ships. The assumption was, and it goes right back to the beginning, it's mirror imaging. The assumption was the Japanese torpedoes had a maximum effective range of less than 10,000 yards because that's about what the American torpedoes could do. But these Japanese torpedoes could reach three times that at some of their speed settings, or more. And at high speed, they were very difficult to dodge at ranges of that nature. So even though the U.S. cruisers tried to stay beyond effective range of these weapons, they did not. And through about the middle of 1943, they were still getting sunk and damaged by these until the American destroyer captains had an opportunity to cut loose like their Japanese counterparts, and it was a different story.
Tom, let's talk a little bit about Hara's wartime experience. You look at his time in the first 6 months of the war, and a lot of it is dull, boring, you know, stuff, escorting convoys. He does get into a couple of battles where he actually sees some action. He commands one of the destroyers that's involved in the Battle of the Java Sea and is at Midway. But really, it's Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands where he makes his bones. And the fact that he survives and that his ships survive when he's aboard really becomes a part of the legend of him being the indestructible destroyer captain in the Japanese Navy, does it not?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's navies are like this. This is a military organization, and most of the people in it are very young. And when you're young, you're looking for somebody to follow, to use as a guide and as a model. And he becomes that, and he's the kind of commander that sailors want to work for, live for, fight for, and die for, because he understands them. He seems to understand what's going on around him, and he's physically brave and creative, and that's the kind of person you want to associate with, the kind of person you want as your leader. So what's interesting to me is that he develops this as the war goes on. He gets into a situation where others are confused or killed, and he survives. And instead of breaking down, as you would expect a person to do under the kind of pressure that he faces, he keeps going. He just keeps going. He gets a crew at one stage, which is not very good, right? And he looks at them, and he says, I got to do something with these guys. And he does. He knows what to do. I think Trent put it very well. This man is an ideal ship captain. It's not at all clear that he's an ideal destroyer division captain or an ideal fleet captain or anything at that level, but he certainly is a very good destroyer captain. He understands how to do this work, and his sense of confidence, in a way, is strengthened as he gets through these different engagements.
And Trent, he develops a reputation not unlike a cobra or a mongoose against the weaklings of the U.S. Navy. He winds up mixing it up with the best of the best. Arleigh Burke, when he was commanding Destroyer Division 23 at Epirus Augustus Bay, and Mooseburger at Columbagaro. I mean, he had the only destroyer to survive that engagement simply because he didn't go and do what the plan said. Talk a little bit about his style of war and how it allowed him to survive and move on.
Well, if my memory is right, he survives that encounter with Mooseburger only because of a dud. I think that's where his ship's rudder gets a torpedo through it. That doesn't detonate.
Later on when they pulled her out of the water in dry dock, they found a 21-inch American torpedo-sized hole in the rudder, to which his comment was, oh, yeah, the rudder's been a little bit, you know, wonky the past couple of months, because he fought with it for a couple of months after that.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's one of those sort of skinnier teeth sorts of things, but it's more than just luck and duds and so on. Hara obviously is good at absorbing these kinds of lessons, which allow him to become a very effective captain and survive in these kinds of engagements. So he's learning things. He's learning how to run a ship effectively. You know, you see this progression through his career, and he's learning how to adjust to things that are going on in these battles. And I think some of this comes from, you were talking about his own philosophy or approach to battle, some of those books that he was looking at before the war or as it's kicking off, and his sort of personal mantra, which is to never do the same thing twice. And the corollary to that is a great willingness to try new things and to experiment. And I'm thinking specifically of the time he describes where his ship is being attacked at night by an American airplane, and they've been in the forefront of the battle for a long time. There hasn't been a lot of capability to refit the ship or recondition her engines. And so when they go to emergency flank speed, flames leap out of the smokestack, and they're worried he's going to break the engines with this huge burst of power that's coming on. But the result is that the attacking plane thinks that the bombs have hit the ship, that it's on fire and done for, and so he's left alone. But he goes as far as to note that that's probably not going to work a second time. So he needs a better answer the next time a plane comes and tries to attack him.
Well, and therein we go back to his basic philosophy of war, which is don't do it twice the same way, the same time, the same place.
Yep.
Tom, one of the realities that we have with Captain Hara, as we had with Fushida, Genda, Saburo Tsukai, and the other authors of these books, is that not a lot of officers at the level of command, of a squadron, of a ship, not a lot of them survived the war. The Imperial Navy was, in a word, decimated. And in fact, Hara was there commanding the last operable light cruiser in the Imperial Navy in April of 45 during the ill-fated sortie of the super battleship Yamato on her suicide run to Okinawa.
Oh yeah,
go ahead.
Well, he understands that this is a foolish mission. You know, he says, "Wait a minute! If we parceled the ships out one at a time or in small groups, you know, if we put together some destroyers and gave them enough fuel, and we set up a mission so that they could go down and actually attack the American fleet in some sensible way, not this suicidal way. If we did that, that would be smarter." I mean, what's interesting is he's always sort of looking at these things at that tactical level. And even on that last mission, he goes along. I mean, he's a committed professional. He's going to do what he's ordered to do, but he understands that it's a mistake. And he begins to see much of what the Japanese Navy did during the war as like that, as that sort of mistake that they can't seem to deal with the situation in the way it ought to be dealt with. I think he would have been quite happy to take the big battleship Yamato and simply let it sit somewhere and take the oil and put it into ships that he felt could be far more effective tactically.
And he and everybody else aboard knew before they ever left harbor that everybody in that force was going to go swimming before it was over with. And, of course, he gives the account of what it's like to have your ship that you command go out from underneath you, and now you're in the water. I mean,
and it's amazing.
Compelling narrative.
It is a compelling narrative because you wonder at the end how he survived. But he did. And it wasn't easy. He's in the water. He had to sustain himself in the water. He wasn't sure if he was going to be able to last in the water after his ship was gone and he had abandoned it. But what's interesting is he never loses his sense of persistence. He stays with the idea that he's professional, he has to serve. He just stays with that and never gives up.
We're coming to the end of the show and the end of what we were starting to talk about when we got started, which is, this is a book which clearly gives you an opportunity to go into the mind, albeit after the war, of the wartime experiences of a very professional naval officer. Tom, you and Trent have both worked extensively in academia, particularly with military officers going through your tutelage and instruction. Looking back on it, if you had control of the reading list for a semester or even a year with young naval officers, be it at the academy, the war college, the industrial college of the United States military, is this the kind of book you'd want on the reading list and that you'd want to have a chat, you know, spend an afternoon or two with your students talking about in an open academic area?
Well, I'm might have wanted to pull some pieces out of the book. The problem is there's so much out there that would be worth looking at. You have to get it together as pieces and then hope they'll take something out of it. The problem with dealing with this book today is that a lot of young Navy officers, I'll take Navy officers, don't know very much about what happened in World War II. And so you you know, you can't just throw them into the book. They need some sort of background. So what I would do with this sort of thing is provide that background, take an excerpt out of the book, and then get them to talk about it. I think that's the only way you're going to do it. You have to give people the necessary background. You can't just throw them into one of these memoirs and say, well, okay, what does it mean? Because they'll go through it wondering, what's going on here? What's really happening? What's that bigger picture? How do I put this particular memoir in context? And it's one thing for me to do that, one thing for you to do it, one thing for Trent to do it. It's something else for someone who's never experienced that context, who's never looked at it. It's something else for them to try to do it.
Well, you make a good point, which is there is value in teaching history, obviously. Trent, what's your point of view on the book, and where would you want to use it if you were back in an academic environment?
Well, I think it could work. I like my father's suggestion of taking excerpts from it and also framing the context. I mean, one of the things that I was thinking is it would be nice to read this in concert with several other works that can help provide a broad point of view in terms of the Japanese Navy's perspective on the war. And I was thinking about things like Kaigun by David Evans and Mark Peaty and Sunburst by Mark Peaty, which give you a good sense of the Japanese Navy's tactical approach to war and some of the asymmetric mechanisms they developed to help deal with the superior size of the United States Navy. And another work along those lines, with it's a bit drier, but I think it's very excellent in terms of setting the stage of how the Japanese Navy approached the war and how they became very focused on both the United States as the main opponents and a decisive battle as the main mechanism through which victory could be achieved. And that's From Mahan to Pearl Harbor by Seito Asada. That's a really effective work, and it touches on some of the same points that Hara brings up. He doesn't spend a whole lot of time on them, but basically says that, you know, after the London Treaty of 1930, the Japanese Navy felt that they'd been embarrassed, you know, one too many times, and the United States Navy was behind this. They were restricting the size of the Japanese Navy, and through that mechanism, basically insulting the nation. And so, you know, the planning mechanisms and the eyes of the leadership of the Imperial Japanese Navy turned to the United States, focused on it as an enemy. Asada deals with that in a much richer way, looking at a lot of the material that has become available since and through the eyes of a very talented historian. So I think that would be a very good way to complement the kinds of things that Hara brings to us through his book.
You both are noted naval historians in your own right. You've both written extensively, and you've been very active the past few years. I guess the question is, what do you guys got next? What are you doing now? What are you going to publish next? And I'll start with Tom. What are you working on?
Well, I'm supposed to be retired, but I'm actually not. The 100th anniversary of the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations is in 2015, and the Navy Department wants a history of those 100 years of Chiefs of Naval Operations and of OPNAV, the staff. And so I'm working with a historian by the name of Curtis Utz, who works for the Naval History and Heritage Command, and together we're going to produce that 100-year history, that centennial history of the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. And hopefully it will be useful to Navy officers and to citizens and to people who have an interest in this sort of thing. The focus of a lot of naval history tends to be on operations and battles and engagements. But it's very important to think about, as Trent says, the organizations that do the planning, the training, the preparation, and so on. And if that's a concern you have, and I think you ought to have it, then you've got to look at the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. So that's what I'm working on.
Will it be published by GPO or any other notable publisher?
Well, if the Navy accepts it, it will.
That's always a useful question. Is it something they're willing to go and admit to? Trent, what are you working on?
I am, well, as I'm sure you know, I've looked a lot at the evolution and development of the U.S. Navy's surface warfare tactics in the first half of the 20th century, essentially from about 1905 up through the end of World War II. And one of the things that I've tried to illustrate is how important the development of pre-war or interwar concepts and thinking were to the outcome in World War II. And what I'm doing now is I'm trying to re-examine that with an eye towards how did that take place? What were the characteristics of the United States Navy's organization and officer corps structure that allowed it to not only take advantage of that pre-war thinking, but exploit it so rapidly during the war? And one of the key elements to that is adaptivity, or that's the term that is used in the business world that I'm working on primarily these days. But it's not just what doctrine did the U.S. Navy take the war, but it's – sorry, there's some static – but it's what circumstances allow them to change that once the war developed and the fighting wasn't exactly how they anticipated it would be. And Hara is a key part of that story. The torpedoes that he and his sailors employed and his colleagues employed were one of the main things that the U.S. Navy had to adapt to. So how was it that they were able to overcome that so quickly? And that's what I want to look at these days.
Very good. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on. You know, there's an old saying that, you know, a friend is someone who'll help you move, a good friend is someone who'll help you move a body, and a great friend is someone who won't even tell you where the body is buried. I want to thank you guys for a lifetime of friendship and being great friends, great peers, and great professionals. It's been good to have you both on.
Well, John, thank you for asking us.
Yeah,
and I'll be talking to you both again soon, I'm sure. Take care, and we'll have you on the next time we need the greatest father-son tag team in naval history.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care, guys.
All right.
And with that, we have gone and finished up another edition of Military Monday. We are going to be coming back with a summer that I think you're going to enjoy a lot. We're going to be covering a lot of different subjects, and as we see what happens across the seas in areas of conflict, we're going to try and make sure that we don't forget those and have some shows that focus on providing context to the kind of events you see going on in the regular news. I hope that you'll continue to follow us. We appreciate your support, and I'll talk to you again next week, Monday, 1 p.m. Eastern, on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. Took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. And he said that he's coming for me. I never loved a soldier until the war.
never cherished freedom. Freedom never cried. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my.
Yeah.